Welcome, people, to the meeting of the Josephine County Rural Planning Commission. Would you join me in the saying of the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Will you call the roll?
Commissioner Church?
Here.
Commissioner Evans?
Here.
Commissioner Glenn?
Here.
Commissioner Boothman? Commissioner Ogden?
Here.
Commissioner Boothman?
Here. Okay, we are lacking a full complement of commissioners, so our alternate, Mr. DeSimone, will be a voting member tonight. So, okay, is any more testimony cards? Okay. I'm required to read procedures for quasi-judicial land use hearing. I'm going to drink water first. This meeting of the Josephine County Planning Commission will be conducted according to the Josephine County Land Use Hearing Rules found in Article 31 of the Josephine County Rural Land Development Code and Section 197.763 of the Oregon Revised Statutes, which govern the conduct of all public hearings. A summary of the rules follows. 1. Planning staff will identify and explain the criteria and standards applicable to this request. 2. Testimony and evidence is to be directed to the criteria and standards. If you feel other criteria or standards apply and are not identified, you must raise the issue to the chair for ruling. If the chair rules that additional standards apply, then testimony and evidence may be directed to them. 3. Clearly raise and explain your issues in this hearing in order to be understood by the commission. 4. Before the conclusion of the hearing, any participant may request a continuance to submit new evidence or testimony. The commission must decide to either grant the continuance or to keep the record open. In either case, the period of time must be at least 7 days. During the time of the, quote, open record, anyone may submit additional written testimony or evidence. 5. All persons testifying are considered a witness unless the person asked to be recognized as a party, and the chair rules the person has party status. Party status is established in 3 ways. 1. Anyone who receives an official mailed notice testifies orally or in writing in this hearing. 2. Anyone who testifies orally or in writing in this hearing who did not receive official mail notice but established the use or enjoyment of their property is adversely affected by impacts from this proposed use of a development that is different from the public at large. And 3, someone who is aggrieved by an adverse decision. The chair will wait until you finish testifying to make a ruling on your party status. 6. Participants are obliged to know and follow the rules and procedures. The planning staff present has a copy of the rules. The first item on the agenda is as follows. We have a public land use hearing for amending the comprehensive plan map of Josephine County from forest to residential, amend the zoning map of Josephine County from woodlot resource to rural residential 5-acre minimum. This is a application by Shannon McCann. And then we have 3 meetings from the Planning Commission, 4 comments from the public, items not on agenda, 5 the Planning Director's report, and then 6 the adjournment. Does anyone object to the jurisdiction of the Commission to hear this matter? 9. Then ask. Does any member of the commission wish to abstain from participant in this meeting. Oh, does anyone wish to, any member of the commission wish to abstain from this matter? The Josephine County Rural Land Development Code sets time limits for the testimony. At the close of the hearing, a decision shall be made in the form of findings, with the presiding officer of the hearing designating who will prepare the findings. The criteria for the decision in this hearing shall be presented by the planning staff as part of the staff report. And Mr. Black, please give the report.
Good evening. This is Black, County Planning Office. First, I need to check this one. Just want to provide you with some background on the application, a little background, get an idea of where the property sits in that county. Then go over some criteria and requirements, and then talk about a few issues and then give you a staff recommendation. Staff received a complete application for this on April 13th. To change the zone of tax lot 300 from Woodlot Resource to R5. As this shows, the property is located off North Applegate Road near the Jackson County border. Property is owned Woodlot Resource, has a comprehensive plan designation of forest. And on this map, we note that to the north, the property abuts BLM lands with forest commercial zones. And to the south and west, we see the property abuts rural residential private lands, and those are under private ownership. The aerial photo shows the property on the north side of Applegate Road and is well vegetated. We want to note that there is a class 2 stream running north and south through the property. The USGS map gives us an idea of the slopes. And per our data, we find that 94% of the property exceeds 15% slopes. It's noted by some red crosshatch. You guys have these maps in your staff reports, so you can see. The property clearly has slope hazards, which is a carrying capacity issue for our department. Criteria to be looked at this evening, section 46040, plan amendment review criteria. If there's a change from a resource designation to a non-resource designation, this hearing body must either meet statewide exception criteria or make a finding under non-resource criteria under section 46050. Also, the application needs to demonstrate carrying capacity. Support the density? Is there potential for increase or decrease hazards to that effect? And is the change consistent with the character of the surrounding area? Section 46050, this is the non-resource criteria. Basically, we're looking at four categories that we need to consider, and that is non-farm. Is this property non-farmland? And considering that, we're going to look at the class six soil or above. Is this non-forest land? Is there a CIR below 3.50? And is the land necessary for farm or forest practices? And is the land not needed for soil, water, air, fish, and wildlife resources? This last bullet indicates that the land will remain under deer rendering density restrictions regardless of zone change. This is a soils map. We find three main soil types on the property, which encompass 92% of it. We have Benoit Gordon's complex, Benoit silkworm, and Siskiyou grab and the sandy one. All three have a class 6 agricultural review. The staff finds the CIR at 3.36, which indicates this is clear that the IR test on this property is obviously not a resource. There have been some changes in the laws more recently when it comes to zone changes. The DLCD informed the county that new AOR revisions require cubic foot growth productivity data for direct tree maintenance on the property for non-forest finding. The DLCD states this rule must be applied under ORS 197-646. As such, staff requires this applicant to address both the county IR system and this cubic foot analysis for a non-forest finding. Under OAR 660-006-0010, this provides the rules to demonstrate the property is non-forest by using the following in the order listed. Each step must be considered in the order we are listed. We cannot move to the next step unless we have adequate findings to justify just by moving to the next step. The first one is we need to assess the USDA and NRCS mapping of the average annual production capability by cubic foot per acre. If we can't get there on using number one, that allows us to drop to number two. Obviously, it says where NRCS data is not available or shown to be inaccurate, other data may be used in the following order. Oregon Department of Revenue, Western Oregon maps, USDA Forest Service Plan Association guides, or other information by the state forester. Where number two is not available or shown to be inaccurate, the applicant may come up with an alternative method for determining productivity, as described in the Oregon Department of Forest Land Use Planning Notes, number 3, April 1998, as updated April 2010. Staff finds four issues with this application. Topography is the staff's biggest concern. In Exhibit B in your packet, page 156 shows a map. So it's like this, of the map. This map provided by the geographer indicates that out of the 19 proposed lots, 10 of these lots will be located in a 40 to 65% slope area. Of the remaining lots shown on the map, they will all be located between 15 and 40% slopes. The Planning Commission needs to make an appropriate finding regarding this issue. The next item is the deer winter density will be exceeded given complete build-out of both the McMahon property and the Wicks property, which is to the south. at an RR5 density. Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife submitted comments in this regard. It's labeled as Attachment A in your staff report. Carrying capacity, given the steep slopes, we have concerns about water availability, potential septic sites, roads, and fire and erosion hazards. Given these issues, it's staff's opinion that going from an 80-acre complex to a 90-acre is considerably high density for this property. You'll find comments from the DLC under Exhibit G in your staff report stressing the same concerns. Staff's recommendation is as follows. Staff agrees with the applicant's non-force findings. However, staff believes the proposed density of RR5 exceeds the carrying capacity of the property due to extreme slopes. As such, staff will support a lower density zone designation for this property. Based on the proposed zone designation of RR5, the application materials, comments from the agencies we correspond with, and review of the applicable criteria, staff can only recommend the Planning Commission for a recommendation of denial to the Board of County Commission. That's all I have for the staff report, if there's more questions.
Any questions from the commissioners?
On your RR5 and larger designations, is there any flexibility at all within those two zones to design with nature rather than design with a regulation?
The way the code's written, you get to choose one and only of the three options in the code. You've got limited development, serpentine, and rural residential at the 5-acre minimum size. Those are the only three options our code has right now. Staff's opinion, there's no flexibility at this point the way that
language is written. Well, if it's one major parcel at the moment, can you not cluster homes in a little tighter density and put the upland into a reserve or a common
there's
property?
There's a tool you can use to accomplish that. It's called PUD, Planned Unit Development. You've got to get the zone changed first.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Black. Mr. Hart? Due to the complex nature of the application, we will allow more than 10 minutes.
Thank you, I appreciate it. As stated, this is a request for a change based on a non-resource determination from forest land to non-resource land. Our request for zoning is from woodlot resource to RR5. One of the things I want to address directly right out front, the RR5 is a minimum size zone, and it's not a mandated zone. So if we do have the application approved, we won't get the maximum density here as if this was flat land and you had 5-acre, what we commonly refer to as cookie cutter lots. We also have the limitation of deer habitat, so the maximum we can get out of the full entire development of the property is less than 20 lots, where you take the acreage divided by 5, it's over 30 lots. But we can't do but 18 or 19 lots maximum. So we have a self-limitation, because the code says even if you come out of resource land, you still have the deer density requirement that still needs to be held in place. So there is some limitations right off the bat. As you saw in your staff report, this property was originally zoned SR5. That was what the county felt was the best zone for this property when it was originally zoned in 1973. When the county was required to adopt a comprehensive plan in conformance with state requirements, they changed it to RR5. They still agreed that that was the best and highest use for this property, and that was the correct zoning. Minimum lot size and not a mandated lot size. It was only when the state of Oregon attached a requirement on Josephine County to come under sanctions because they felt that there was too much land put in the residential zone based on the population. There was no consideration of whether it was forest land, farmland, or any other kind of land. They just said you had too much resource land, and so instead of maintaining an enforcement order on Josephine County changed zone on more than 50,000 acres in Josephine County. This is one of the properties that was caught up in that requirement. At this point, we finally come to the point in the land use process where we can bring tools to bear to completely identify and give you the facts of is this resource land or not. Josephine County adopted a cumulative internal rate of return system for evaluating forest land to see if it really would be commercial forest land and be productive. In this case, the property, as you see in the documentation submitted before you, is below that threshold. It's at 3.36, which is below the 3.50. So we do conform to the plan requirements that we show that it's non-resource under the IRR system. The state of Oregon in 2011 adopted a new set of standards under that OAR 660-006-010. It says now you have to identify forest land using the NRCS information. It doesn't say what the threshold is for commercial forest land, it just says you must use NRCS information if it's available or if it's accurate. And then they go through a matrix of if it's unavailable or inaccurate, then you use other situations or other forms of data. The county was not notified that this system was being adopted, and it was adopted as, quote, a housekeeping item. There was no discussion of what this would physically do to land use plans throughout the state, and Josephine County was caught up in a new set of rules that was, quote, housekeeping item. To try and address these things, we have to have a comparison to see is the NRCS information accurate. Based on the NRCS information that's shown in your book on page 127, that takes each soil and gives it a rating of what the productivity should come from that soil. When you average it all out, this property should grow 92 cubic feet per acre per year over the entire parcel. We don't know if that's inaccurate based on what information they gave us until we try and compare it to something. We'll demonstrate that by using a forester's report that is allowed under the land use planning notes as outlined in the But we have to go through a couple steps before we get to that point. The next thing, if we feel that the NRCS information is inaccurate, then we must go to the Department of Revenue maps, and they go through a conversion factor, and this is rated as an FG area for the entire parcel. It says it should produce between 50 and 84 cubic feet per acre per year. So last Friday, a letter was sent to the property owner from the assessor's office saying, we're sorry, we don't feel that the property meets that standard anymore, and we're declassifying your property, and now you will have to pay back taxes because it is no longer under a forest assessment. We feel that that is evidence that the forest, or that the assessment records are wrong, the Department of Revenue wrong, maps are inaccurate. The next thing we have to go to is the Forest Service Plan Association Guide. We reviewed that. It does not have any productivity. All it says is in these areas, these are the kinds of trees, and this is a percentage of growth. You've got so much fir, so much pine, and so much other drones or other types of information, but it has no productivity information. So that is missing information. From there, we went to a professional forester as described in the land use planning notes. That forester is here today, and he'll explain what he went through to try and show what he found on the property. The conclusion is, based on his information from the directory measurement, that the entire property, on average, produces 6.25 cubic feet per acre per year, which is an abysmal type of forestry growth. We'll have the property owner talk about that a little bit later as well. Once we address the forestry issues, we have to go to the farm issues. In this property, there's 7 acres of soils that are classified as class 1 through 4, which is about 4% of the entire property. The standard is if it's less than 51%, then it is not forest land or farmland. So on the two major issues, farm and forest land, there's direct evidence that's in your packet that shows that it doesn't meet the standards for either type of resource management. We also go through a description of what are the operations in the area of other resource lands. There is BLM land in the north. It has the same type of soil that's at the top of this property. There is no worshipable trees on the area that is adjacent to the Shannon property. So we don't feel that it is consistent with any type of forest management in the area. The air photos, we have one shown by staff. This is the air photos from 2002, and you can see the sparseness of the area. Here's the 2005. We have a little bit on some of the north-facing slopes that have a little bit of a break from the hot summer sun. Here's the 2012 air photo off of Google Maps. We see the same type of thing, just a very minimal amount of any type of tree growth. When we look at the soils, and the soil maps are in your pack as well, this is the subject property right here. This is that 2.91 IRR soil. It's the same soil that's on the adjacent BLM. They have no management plan other than fuel reduction for that area. Well, we don't feel that there is any type of resource management in the area that this property would be essential to carry on any of those forest operations. The next issue is carrying capacity. You have copies of reports from the Galley Group, which is a geotechnical and hydrologist that will, Mr. Galley is here to explain his reports. They will talk about the carrying capacity of the land. Is there adequate water? As you can see in the reports and the well logs, there's 2 wells on the subject property. The average well yield in this area is 16.25 gallons a minute, which is more than adequate for residential type of development. We look at septic suitability on page 201 of your staff report. There's a report from Mr. Maurer, who's a certified soil scientist. He said that he looked at the property. I went out and walked it with him and showed him the development plan for the 19 lots, saying, can we get septic systems on there? And his response is, yes, you can get septic systems on there. It will be a combination of standard systems and sand filters. But yes, we can do it. They have to be placed carefully to meet DEQ standards. But there is adequate information there for Mr. Maurer to show that there is adequate capability for acceptance of civility. Other carrying capacity is traffic. There's reports in here from the Oregon Department of Transportation saying that they looked at their systems, they looked at the proposal. It does not cross the threshold that there is an adequate transportation system to serve the area. There's a report from the Josephine County Public Works Department saying that they have no problems with this. There's an adequate transportation system. And here's where I get frustrated, is we got a letter from Jackson County saying, we have concerns about the traffic system because North Applegate Road goes clear over to Little Applegate, and they had concerns about the traffic system. So we hired a traffic engineer. He went through the analysis of the project to the maximum development possible of 32 lots. He went through the planning period, which is a 20-year growth period. And his conclusion was that there is adequate capacity for this project. There's finally a response from Jackson County saying, well, we think that there's a couple of extra traffic crashes that you didn't report, but other than that, we don't have any problems with your report and we agree with it. So there's adequate transportation systems. So those are the three major carrying capacity things of water, septic suitability, and transportation. Then we get to the other issues of flood hazard. There is a portion of the property, that little triangle area south of the road, that is in a flood hazard area. It's not proposed for development because it is in a floodway area down there, so that area would not be developed. It's not considered as a separate lot. It will be a part of one of the lots north of the roadway, so we don't feel that flood hazard will be an issue. We look at slope. Yes, this is a steep property on portions of it. It gets steeper as you go higher into the property. As you saw from staff, we have the USGS topo sheet. Those are 40-foot contours, and they're not very accurate. It's a generalization. We have some digital elevation models. These are 20-foot contours, and it's much wider in this area in the center of the property. And that's where the smaller lots are proposed, 5 to 6 acres. But as we get out to these extremities, those are larger lots, and it would address the concern of slope stability. We'll have the engineer talk about that in more detail. We have this kind of a representation of what does the area look like. This is such a property outlined in red. I zoomed in on it a little bit more. As you can see, there's a bowl right here in the middle of the property that is a lower slope, and that's where the primary portion of development would be, as you can see in the design that's proposed, that's submitted to you. And it's not a final design. We can come back with a planned unit development to try and cluster lots smaller into the lower slope areas. But our responsibility here in this hearing is to show that there is adequate capacity for the proposed use, which is the 5-acre zoning that we cannot go to maximum density. So we don't feel that an artificial limitation to a 20-acre minimum lot size is warranted and justified in this case, because we weren't trying to get 30 lots out of it anyway. We're about a little more than half of what the maximum density would be. We feel that there is adequate information in the record to show that it does meet the carrying capacity. The last issue that is talked about is, does it meet the development pattern of the area? Here's the zoning. Subject property is here. As you can see, right next to the property to the south east, is an RR5 property that was recently approved by Josephine County from a woodlot resource to RR5 based on the same criteria that's before you tonight. There is a finding that it met not only the non-resource determination, but it met the requirement to be consistent with the development pattern in the area. As you can see along Northside Road here, above the roadway, there's clusters of RR5 all along. Here's Board Shanty, here's Kubley Road, and there's just all kinds of RR5 along that north side. Between North Applegate Road and Highway 238, there's that area of the Applegate River. Part of it is exclusive farm, which is good bottomland soils, great for farming, and there are a few large farms in there. There's also, in these blue areas, aggregate resource, where it's a good source of, or has been a good source of rock in the past for development. So this area between the two roadway systems is not rural development, and we don't propose going south of that roadway to infringe on any of that area. And then you look on the other side of Highway 238 as we head down toward Williams, we find the same type of pattern along the roadways to the south of that, which you get out of that alluvial plain of the river. You find RR5 developed along those low foothills. We look at development. These blue areas here show properties that are assessed as having houses on each one of these parcels. As you can see, they're clustered along this roadway system, which is the development pattern for the area. We do have some wide open spaces that are white areas that are not developed. But we look at the ownership pattern, those white areas that don't have any developed, they're owned by the federal government, which is a lot of the ONC land that came back. There was not a consideration of this is great forest land, it's just land that was deeded back to the federal government because of the failure of the ONC railroads. And that's why it's not developed. So we feel that we're consistent with land use pattern in the area. So we feel that we have met the burden of proof of all the portions of the code, that it is not farmland, it's not forest land, it has the carrying capacity for the proposal, and it meets the development pattern of the area. The last thing that people talk about that we want to discuss here is deer habitat. There is a requirement that we meet the maximum standard of no more than 32 dwellings per 2 square miles. It's kind of a floating area where you look at the existing pattern of houses, not the existing pattern of lots. We look at houses. Are there houses on any of those parcels? Because I've looked at parcels throughout the county. Some places we've had to tell people, you don't meet the density standard for your habitat, and therefore you cannot have a house. That's one of the reasons why we propose this limited density of a maximum 18 dwelling units, or 19 dwelling units, based on the number of houses within the 2 mile area. In your book, it talks about the process that we went through. It's on page 17. And then further back in the report, there's a map and a database that shows how we evaluated the houses in the area to meet the standards, so to meet the technical requirements of the code. I think that pretty well addresses the standards that we have here. I do have something to submit to the commission. We have 3 letters of support for this for this proposal. One, Robert Hill at 10561 North Applegate Road. Martha Love at 11071 North Applegate Road. The property address is 11390 Applegate Road, so we're right in this area. And I think this is one of the big coups right here. The Standard Noble, the Noble Dairy, which has the biggest farm out there, and they have no problems with this property change as proposed. It would not affect their farm operation, which is, the largest dairy in the area.
Given the Commissioner DeSimone, and we'll all look at it and put it in the record.
Well, if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer those before we bring up the experts, the engineer, and the forester that has evaluated this project.
Question: is the Noble property abut close to this land, or how far down the road is it?
There's the subject property right here. This green area right here starts the Noble property going down here. here's the roadway, here's the little corner of the subject property, so it's not quite directly across the street, it's one property down and across the street.
But the dairy is quite a ways down, isn't it?
Yeah, the dairy is quite a ways down, but the one, the part that would be most impacted by this, if there would be an impact, it's the open fields, the hay fields there for...
So there's no people there?
There's no people there.
I thought there's a few houses down from Noble's area. Are those Noble's rentals?
There's some property houses further in here. There's a couple over here that were part of the Gallo property. Gallo has recently sold the rest of their holdings to Noble. Mr. Church.
Mr. Hart, thank you. I just have a need a clarification on the deer winter range. I was looking at page 57 of your report. It's really clear, but what I'm confused about is if somebody else gets busy and completes a subdivision request, builds houses, does that reduce your allowance?
It reduces the allowance of building houses unless the deer habitat standards are changed, which has been proposed, it's been through the commission, and I think it's headed for the board. When we look at the deer habitat issues from Fish and Wildlife, the major concern is from the area south of Williams, headed over Grayback into the Illinois Valley. Those are the major areas. This area north here, there is not a herd that really moves up and down, so we're hoping that the standards could be changed in the future, but we are required to meet the standards as they,
but as they stand now.
And today, if somebody comes in and builds a house, then this property would be reduced by the number of houses that are built. It's, I don't know if it's a fair system, but it's a system that Josephine County has adopted. First comes, first served, is whoever is there. I know the Wicks property, it's a total of 32 acres. There's an existing dwelling on that property. There's been no proposal to develop that. It's been about 2 years since that zone change. So those are...
From your perspective, does it have to be houses built, or is it subdivision lots approved?
The code says houses built.
Houses built, okay. Thank you.
So was there any reference or letters from Wicks? That came back? Was there a letter or reference from Wicks that came back on a response to the proposal?
We heard nothing back from Wicks. I haven't heard anything from them.
Staff received no comments for this application from the public.
And being an adjoining property owner, they did get official notice, but there's been no response.
Was there any letters returned on visual concerns?
Visual.
Yes.
Excuse me, let me interrupt briefly. I neglected to instruct the commissioners to identify themselves for the tape, so our secretary knows who's speaking. So,
okay, I'm Bob Etner. I live at 12984 Williams Highway, which is about a mile south of the proposal. We send out letters to neighbors or the neighborhood. But in this case, you're building, proposing structures up the slope, which are viewed from across the valley, all the way from Crystal Drive back up to my area. I look out the kitchen and can view that slope. It is pretty dominant slope, goes up the hill, and pretty dry, very strong southerly exposure. In fact, if you look at the southern exposure and wildlife, critical wildlife range, deer, winter deer range, it's, if you had a 45% slope, south aspect is equivalent to being at the equator. For wildlife, that's a pretty nice force in the middle of winter or early spring when you're having the babies come along. It's a good habitat. That's probably why it's a critical deer habitat. But there's no information relative to the visual impact to people that sit and look to the north.
That's not a standard in the code requirement.
But it is an impact.
Well, would it be an adverse impact, I guess, would be the question, because it says, is there a significant adverse impact to where it would reduce your ability to manage your property based on what happens?
When you're developing on steep terrain, usually there's pretty good dominant road cuts, house sites, lights, and other things that weren't there before. So, yes, it would be a fairly major impact for some people on that side, but there was no request from input from people from that side, nor is there in our planning thing anything relative to visual impacts, which could be even a house color or something like that next to you.
Based on the statements you've made, I guess one of the questions that I would have, if you can see this property and you would be impacted by that, does that impact your ability to make a decision without having the impact?
No, I'm saying that there's people that don't even know that this is being proposed and that they weren't informed that there is such a potential for impact.
There is a requirement by state statute that says what the area is that must be notified, and those were required. Those were met by the planning staff, so everybody did. And it's also in the public paper, so anybody has the ability to come in and testify. I see there's people in the audience. I'm sure that they will be testifying either for or against this operation.
Any other commissioners have any questions for Mr. Hart?
Commissioner DeSimone, 12701 Williams Highway. Page 17 and page 57, you talk about this critical deer range. The fixed area test, would that allow 7 new dwellings or 8? It mentions 7 on page 17, but it appears you mentioned 8 additional dwellings within the study area on page 57. And the other question would be, if you went with the alternative density calculations, that would, in effect, knock out any other lot owners in that area to develop any other homes, potentially. Correct? If you went with the 18 and maximized.
18, that would be the maximum.
For that 2-mile radius?
But because of the way the code is designed, that you work from the center of the property and build a study area. And if the property that would be impacted by this one, on that logic, if their study area is centered on their property, it would normally pick up some additional property that isn't developed, especially with the amount of BLM. So there would be other properties that would still be developable even under this system. So we're not taking up all of the possible development for the entire Applegate Valley.
Thank you, Mr. Hart. We'll now proceed to hear from the applicant's witnesses and others that are in favor.
Thank you.
Pass those letters.
This letter.
My name is William Galley, senior principal of the Galley Group. I'm a technical civil engineering firm, principal officer, Mass Pass, in Seattle.
What's your address, sir? Your address?
I'm sorry, address here is 612 Northwest 3rd Street, Mass Pass.
Thank you.
Some of you here have seen our work and I've testified before you, others I haven't. I'll give you a real quick scenario of who I am. Attended the U.S. Naval Academy in class 72 and got a bachelor's and master's later at Oregon State University. Geotechnical engineering and water resources. I worked for Santa Cruz, one of the top geotech firms in the country for 5 years in the 70s. I ran a 50-person office of geotechnical in the Bay Area for 6 years. And then ran a 40-person office of geotechnical engineering in Seattle for 5 years. And then I started the Gallagher Group up there and moved back here in 94 because of some family issues. And I've been practicing here ever since. Currently have a staff of about 12. Pleasure to talk to you this evening. We're going to address carrying capacity issues dealing with soil and water septic issues, erosion, just that, try to get it really quickly. My associate passed out a handout to give some more information on all these issues, and then in our original report, as a rebuttal to some of the comments that were sent in by other people in DCLD, DLCD, and then there's some photos that go with them. One of the things that I want to mention is as some of you know, we're pretty serious about our work. Not everybody in the area uses us because we require them to go by pretty stringent standards when they do development. We've had a number of PUDs and subdivisions approved by the commission in the past. All of them have been built. We haven't had any problems. Any of them. Several of them in areas that are much steeper than this and have much more higher ones. So just up front, I don't see this as a real big problem, quite frankly. Especially since they're going much lower than 5 acre minimum. They're most of the lots are going to be 8, 9, 9.5 acres that they want. Couple things that I want to get. DLCD had a lot of real negative comments, most of them based on soil maps that they read, the old SCS soil maps. One thing that we know about those are done gross generalizations for large area tracts of land, not for site specific. You have to be on the site to see what's on the site, and they obviously weren't on the site. And I'm going to go through that and show you why. I think there's really no problem with carrying capacity and the issues that they brought up. I don't see terrain as an issue, not that we are committed to Mr. Blaster. I think he said there were 10 lots in the 40-65% range. I think you'll notice if you look at that map, it's 53, that the 50-40% area is yellow. And the 40-65% is green. I think you'll notice that on almost every site, the house locations are on the yellow zone, 15-40%. There are 3 or 4 locations where the roadway cut across the steeper areas. But because a lot might have 40-65%, if we're not touching it, it doesn't really matter. Almost all of the lots, I would say probably 90% of the roadways are in the 15-40% area. 40% is 2.5 to 1. Most of that area is 3 to 1 or flatter. Those are really easy slopes to build roads on. We did 3,000 feet, 2,800 feet of road for Boulder Ridge. Most of it was through 7%. No problem. It's not a cheap road, but if it's engineered right and constructed right with the proper erosion control, you can do it on most parcels that aren't super steep and not have a problem. This is not a super steep piece of land. We looked at cuts and fills in the area, some off-site, some on-site. Some were given in those photos. With the photo 1 and 2, there's 8 to 15 foot high cuts, 1 to 1 cuts to 30 feet. You can see they're vegetated, no erosion, no feathers. This is on Hawks Drive, about a half a mile away. They actually have a cut that's 50 feet or more, just like 3 to 1. I was kind of surprised to see that there. Minimal erosion, no feathers at all. We went on site. There's some photos. Photos 4, 5, and 6 show some cut slopes 6 to 20 feet on site. There's one of them that is about 15 feet. It's vegetated. It's about 65% slope. It's got some mudrone and evergreens on it. I must admit, I was a little surprised that I really could hardly find any erosion on this parcel. There's roads winding all over. Look at the aerials and some of the early maps that we put in here. You'll see all the light lines, these roads go all over. There's a lot of paths that are cut where they have equipment stored. One of the photos there, I think photo 5 or 6, has a 20-foot cut that's almost vertical. And there's some loose stuff at the bottom that looks more like excavating rather than fall. Now, we're not proposing vertical cuts, but we also saw down the road about a quarter of a mile on a 45% slope. I measured it with my client. They have a 15-foot fill on there, no problems at all. So when you look at the roads that are proposed, most of the cuts and fills are under 10 feet total. 10 feet, you might have a 6-foot fill and a 4 or 5-foot cut with the slope back setback, you might have a little bit on that. Those were all over the hill and there was no evidence of failure anywhere that I could see. And most of these cuts were almost vertical. Now, we would not have vertical cuts. We would propose cuts more like 1 and 1 and 1.2 and 1. So that there wouldn't be any problem at all. We also looked at erosion of the ditches. I'll do that in a minute. Driveways and building mats, similar type thing. On the roads, there were a few places that might take a 20-foot combination cut fill. But we saw several out there that were 25 to 30, just counting the 50-foot cut. We're not going to propose anything like that. They're going to be kept to a minimum. And some of these roads may be moved over from, you know, when we get to the final layout to fit where current roads are. Because they have current roads that are stable, that have been there for, they look like at least 15 years. And they're almost full width. So it wouldn't take a lot of work or a lot of tree removal to work roads right in on these. But the building pad, one of the things that we would recommend is they use like daylight basement. So maybe if you have a 15 or 16 foot elevation change across your building pad, you put in a basement, you've got about a 9-foot wall there. So now you only have like a 3-foot fill in the front and 4-foot cut in the back. Not that big, really very easy to do. And it doesn't denude large areas of vegetation. So stability overall, the formations are pretty stable. I look all around the maps. We don't see any evidence of large-scale slope failures or slope failures other than half a cubic yard off of any of the cut slope. There were a couple places where people had cut some near vertical and there might have been a 2-yard thing off the top. But that's just not something that we can do. And those were all slump outs in the upper 2-3 feet of the topsoil that gets really saturated. You typically expect that if the cuts are done properly. The erosion issue, same thing. Which if you look off-site, on-site, I was kind of surprised to see road cuts 0.5 to 1 to 1 to 1. Really steep. No erosion vegetating on that box drive, on North Applegate Road, on the site. We saw road site ditches. There's a, I think it's photo 8, there's one in Hawks Drive, there's a 15% section of road there where they have not very large rock in the invert of the ditch, no erosion problem. Photo 9 shows one off the site. It's a 15% section of roadway at the bottom of the hill. It's not rock at all, it just has grass in it. There's no erosion. And one of the things that we clearly look at is there's enough silt and clay to help hold the soil, you know, when you get the granitics, they're mostly silt and sand. They erode readily. You get a little silt and clay, as long as it's not so much to compromise the overall slope of the building, it's really good for preventing erosion. They aren't as erosive as you think. Only place that I found any erosion deeper than maybe an inch was one area of a fill where they didn't do any erosion control in the water. But that's not something that can happen. Septic capacity, there were some questions brought up about the adequacy of sand systems. I talked to the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality Office in Medford about this. They started using improving those in the early 80s. They said that they have no knowledge of any gross failures of those at all in Southern Oregon. They said obviously there could be some that somebody didn't maintain, but they have no knowledge of any septic system. Their feeling definitely is if there had been a lot of problems, they would hurt. Their words were, this is a Cadillac system. You just do the maintenance, you have no problem. So I think that's not grounded in fact when they say sand systems don't work. One of the things we know is that when this goes to a point where they're going to get approval for building on the lots. First, approval of either subdivision, and then approval for building on the lots. They're going to have to show ODEQ approval, septic system, for those specific percentage of lots, and then finally for every lot. And so whatever is proposed is going to be something that ODEQ approved, which meets the quality standard. There was sort of a semi-not sure from one of the state people about the water resources. I had our groundwater hydrologist, senior groundwater hydrologist and staff, look at this, and he wrote the report that's in appendix A. I reviewed it very carefully. I looked at a number of other things. There's several ways. And when you look at that, you can see there was only one well in the area that was less than 5 gallons. No, that was three. They drilled it deeper and they got 15. Other than that, the wells were above standard. A couple other ways this could be handled pretty easily is either shared wells or community water system. When you pencil this out based on code requirements, first three lots are 5 gallons a minute, the rest of them at 400 gallons a day, you end up with about a 20 gallon a minute demand. You probably want to get 35 or 40 to be safe. But you can easily put wells down at the bottom of the hill into the alluvium, the younger alluvium of the Applegate River. They're far enough away from the river you can very well show it does not hydraulically connect to the river, so you're not depleting the river's resources. Wells in that typically produce 25 to 50 gallons, easily 15. You can put three wells in so you have some redundancy. So if one goes down, you still have plenty of capacity while you work on one. And it's a pretty easy thing to do. You can set up some water tanks within that can be used for fire suppression. And we've done that on several of the UDs. It's not a complicated thing. There's plenty of water resources run off in that basin. And Applegate River, all its bed banks, if you look out there, most of them out there, they're sand and gravel and cobbles. You get a lot of recharge into the deeper fractures just from the Applegate River. So it wouldn't have an impact on the river, wouldn't have an impact on adjacent wells. The closest well looks like it'd be about 800 or 1,000 feet. It's pretty deep, it's at 25 gallons a minute. And the recharge swale that it's in is over a slight ridge from where these wells are. So I don't see that as any problem at all. Then the other wells are even further and further away. They're too far away for these to influence. You would assume if this was done with community wells, which would have the highest capacity and the biggest draw, and that type of material, you assume that you would assume the cone of depression might pull out 400 or 500 feet of that in this type of material. My guess is they wouldn't pump enough continuously to have a cone of depression is when you pump a well down, it starts dewatering. As the water machine starts dewatering the cone. The deeper you go, the bigger the cone, the dewatered area centered on the well. We've done a lot of pump tests on these types of things throughout in California here. And I just don't see that as an issue at all. There's plenty of water where if this development went through with all 18, you wouldn't see a depletion in the groundwater. It's not in depletion now when you look at the historic record of the county wells. The seasonal fluctuation, but the trend up down is within about a 2 foot span. And most of these wells are the static water levels 120 to 150 feet above where they get first water, so they got a lot of artesian coming out of these fractures. There's just a lot of water in this area. For this number in this small amount of pumping, just not an issue. And I think it would be easily shown in the pump test, I guess the point was have to be done. Stated there's one class 2 stream on the site. Discuss these water courses across the property, the two of them shown when they come together. Discuss with the residents. They indicated it's just after it stopped raining, they stopped flowing. No water in the line. So they're really intermittent streams of that. That being said, there will be a riparian setback requirement from the FMW. That would be adhered to in any design that we did, and that would be the contractor, the developer of the lots, they would be held to that, so the riparian zone would not be affected at all. Those types of streams do allow crossings of roads, and those will be done in accordance with both the Wilson County Public Roads Department, and if because they're a defined channel, there's jurisdiction for Department of State Lands, the Corps, just Army Corps of Engineers, and ODFW, and if they require permits, those would be obtained.
Sir, could you, well, it gets a time factor, could you summarize that last point on the general threat to the environment?
Yeah, there's a lot of roads. One of the things is the road area and cut paths, not quite as much, but about probably about 60% of what will be there, and there hasn't been any complaints at all that I know of about either that they're destroying everything that was put there. I did a quick computation. If you assume 10,000 square feet for each building category, which is really large, and I don't think we'll be having that. And the roadways, you come up with about 7 acres, which is about 4.5% of the entire property. Now, you might cut a few extra trees, so maybe you might end up with 6%. That's a real small percentage, that 168 acres or whatever it is, that some trees will be removed. There are already trees removed from a lot of roadways. So, in summary, we don't think that the soil, or terrain, or water issues constrain this from not being developed. From our opinion, it's sort of a medium difficulty to get design and construction thing that can be done without having any adverse impact to its property or adjacent parcels.
Thank you, sir.
Lynn, I have one question to Mr. Galley. Thank you. I just want to make sure I was clear on the streams. It's been stated there was a Class 2 stream. Right. I assume a Class 2 stream has to run continuously. But you're saying that they're just not Class 2 streams.
Well, I'm not going to say they're not a Class 2 stream if ODFW is classified that. Then
yeah, but...
there's just no water.
I'm with you.
So, one of the things we make is there's no resident fish, and there are really no fish passing requirements.
It showed there should be no riparian issues either.
Well, except that, you know, they do go into classifying anything now that supplies food to the river, which would mean things floating down in that, as critical salmon habitat, even though there's no fish there. And so that would be an issue that whatever ODFW says goes, and that's what would be done with the engineering, so that was the life of that.
Thank you. I understand.
Thank you, sir. Okay, next we'll hear from Shannon McMahon.
No, we've got one more expert, Mr. Fuller.
Oh, okay.
Expert.
Okay.
Yep. We've used 5 minutes.
Yeah. 5 minutes, sir.
My name is Norman Fuller. I'm a consulting forest group. I was at 2016 Billwood Avenue, Medford, Oregon. I conducted the forest productivity analysis on this property. This is the second one I've done based on the revisions we made in 2010 for the Oregon Department of Planning. The staff had a couple of three areas, and I think you've all got a copy of the letter I just submitted on my report. And the first one is correct in their observation of my reporting 73 to 111 per acre is range of site index numbers. The web soil survey lists a range of productivity that should have been corrected and reported as 86 to 157 cubic feet per acre. I made a mistake. I copied the wrong numbers when I was preparing the report. It doesn't have any material impact on any of the conclusions. They had a concern, I'm not too sure I fully understand what it is, but determining how I dealt with the Oregon Department of Revenue, Western Oregon site class maps. And all I can say about those is they are a very general application of forest site classes that were determined by the Department of Revenue years ago when we used to tax standing timber as real property. That is no longer done. But for some reason, in order to take and determine values for assessment purposes, they use the site classification system that they have, and it's an alphabetic. It's an FA through FX designation on about 8 classifications, 7 classifications. The first row has been very general, and what I can see on some of the maps in my original report there, the whole township is designated as FG, which is Forest Site Class 5. That is not site-specific when you get down and trying to determine input production per acre. You actually have to go out and measure what's going on, and that's what I did. And then their last comment, the staff went out and looked at the vegetation in regard to this Forest Service Plan Association guide. They chose one that they liked. I use one that I keep in my files, and I just use it as an example for all of my reports. Because there is no forest productivity information in those plant association guides. They have little or no use for forest planting or management purposes. In terms of overall productivity, the web soil survey, it's a process of elimination. The web soil survey generally overstates forest productivity. Department of Revenue Forest Classification or Forest Classification or Site Classification is very general, and it needs, again, it's general. It needs to be verified on the ground. Those original surveys that they did are based on a very small sample of forest properties throughout the state. And then finally, eliminating the plant association guides with no productivity information. This means you have to go out and field verify anything that's stated in the records. And this is an on-site examination. What I found is that there's only about 20 acres where I can sample trees that were in natural, fully stocked stands. It could be measured for forest productivity. And when you do that, determine the forest productivity on that 20 acres, average it across the total property, you come up with 6.6 acres, 6.6 cubic feet per acre per year, 6.25 cubic feet per acre per year, averaged over the whole property. This is not commercial or forest land by definition. And the primary reason for it is too hot, too dry, and so on and so on.
Thank you.
Anybody have any questions?
Okay. Anybody have any questions, commissioners?
Yes, Commissioner Bob Entner. If it's not good for forest, do you think a fuel loading could be a hazard out there?
Fuel loading can always be a hazard, yes.
Did you see any hazard that was apparent that you would recommend changes to the vegetative pattern?
No, it's just natural vegetation, hardwoods and conifers, and if any of those areas are developed, they're going to have to meet a fire safety density standard upon construction of a home or a dwelling. So the vegetation can stand as it is. It's all natural.
Well, in the report they said there would be some modifications and activities done to reduce the fuel loading, fuel hazard, but it said that would mitigate a lot of things. But wouldn't the opposite be if you add a lot of people to that area that your fire risk goes up?
Anytime there are people around, or homes, there is an increase in fire risk. Yes.
And
that again is something that people have to deal with when they live out in rural areas.
Well, it's also a hot southerly aspect with the valley winds in the afternoon, evening. Does that have anything to do with what you would recommend on that management of fuels?
Fuel management is not required under the Department of Forest and Rules or any other rules that I know of, except for the siting standards when you build the house. But the conditions that you talked about exist throughout the valley. Most or more.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Now we'll have Shannon come in. You'll have 5 minutes, ma'am.
I'm Shannon McMahon, wife of John McMahon. John passed away about 4 years and 4 months ago. And so I'm trying to, John was in the planning commission for a while, so he knew what was going on. And so we went through, when we bought the property 54 years ago, SR5, and then the commission 37, and then I don't know if you guys remember Larry Brown or not, but John, I heard Larry coming to do the logging, and he pulled out early because it wasn't profitable enough. And so John and I, we worked and brought the property up to where it is now. And we have 3 children and 16 grandchildren. And all I really want to do is split up my land so I can give to my children and grandchildren. And I am very fortunate that they want to come back to the ranch. And the hill is just a really nice place, and it's not good for anything, really, except for just home sites. And you can't farm it, you can't log it, and it's got some really pretty home sites. And like I say, I'm very, very fortunate that my children and grandchildren want to come back to the ranch. But my aim is to be able to break it up and to be for them to have their own special spot and before I die. And this is what I'm trying to do.
Excuse me, ma'am.
Yes.
Do any of the commissioners have any questions? None. Okay. Thank you.
No.
Thank you, ma'am. Next in favor, William McMahon.
Hello, I'm William McMahon. I live in 2665 Pine Hills Drive in Eugene, Oregon. I am Shannon's son. I've been associated with this property my entire life. I have walked out every inch of the property, and as I've gotten older, I would love to retire. Built a house on the property. Over the years, I've worked with my dad to try to find the best development for this property. I went to the extent of having a total map made and began to set out whether there was good development lots. I'm really happy when we were able to hire the Galley Group to sort of define that design. I think together with my knowledge of the property and Galley's engineering expertise, I think that we can put together a really excellent plan and a plan that will facilitate developing pieces of property at home for my family. So anyway, through my entire life, I've seen people develop property all around my dad's property. I think, as it stands now, my mom is the oldest resident on the Applegate Valley in that area. I just find it very hard to believe that we lived someplace that long, and the property rights have to be held for the family and the kids. So that's all we want to do.
Any questions from any of the commissioners? Thank you, sir. Thomas Pertzer?
Oh.
MD?
MD, yes. Yeah. I'm Thomas Pertzer, P-U-R-T-Z-E-R.
Okay.
And my address is 2335 Hillside Drive, Central Point. I'm a Grants Pass resident, and I'm a neurosurgeon, board certified neurosurgeon, but I'm not practicing neurosurgery any longer. I practice pain management, mainly take care of young adults addicted to pain pills and heroin. That's what I do for this. I've known the McMahons ever since I set eyes on my wife at age 13. And I'm, about 15. I'm 16. And I've known that they wanted to develop that property ever since I've known them. John was very devoted to that land. My parents, my dad was a physician here in town for over 40 years. My mom was an RN. They still live on 4th Street, and they've lived there for over 50 years. They used to joke, and they said, well, someday you'll be moving out to the South Fork and living there with all the McMahons. That was the plan that they had, that everyone would come back there and live there. We came back from my residency training over 20 years ago, and we've been wanting to move out there and to develop something out there for a long time, at least that long, to build a house or to build some type of residence or something to so that we can start to move out of that area. And we haven't been able to do that. Now, I'm probably going to live to be 160, so it's not a big deal. But I am 60 years old, and I would someday like to live out there, possibly with my wife. So I'm in favor of them having the ability to develop this property. I know that they're very, very careful. John built lots of roads out there. That was his deal, building roads, cutting paths. He was, as Mr. Galley pointed out, he did a very careful job, and I know that very careful about that. They have a love for the land, and they're very careful in their development. They have a good relationship with all the neighbors there, and I know that they would not negatively impact them. They put out a lot of money trying to get this property developed to work through this process, and it's been very frustrating to them, and I can understand that. That's the way our system is. It's become very complex here. I remember when I was growing up, I lived on 4th Street, and I could ride my banana bike all the way to Cape Vancouver and never hit a single one. Now I'd be run over 500 times. So the town has changed a lot. Everything has changed a lot, but I don't think the McMahons have changed much. They've had the same desire ever since I've known them, and they still have that desire to move out there and create South 40. So, any questions?
Thank you, sir. Next witness in favor, Norman Fuller. Okay. Gotcha. Regina Pertzer?
Pertzer.
Pertzer.
Or in. So
As my husband has shared with you, we have a real strong family bond. I have a brother that you heard from and a sister, and we have several children between us, and we have a real desire to go back and be able to live on the farm, in the ranch. And we have a strong desire to take the investments that we now have accumulated and instead of living in Central Point, we're going to go back to Grants Pass, which is where I think all of us are going to be back to. But we found nothing but roadblocks with that, so it's been pretty frustrating. I find it really, really sad to see and find my mother having to spend her retirement money, thousands and thousands of dollars, attempting to develop a property that was originally zoned SR5 and was then taken to RR5. And again, my husband did mention that my father was on the plan committee, sitting right here where all of you are, and he was aware of the difficulties and stuff with dividing and the changes and the trends of what was happening in the county. But he felt very, very strongly that he did not want to do what a lot of our neighbors have done, which is divide up and sell the property and have other people living on it. He was very, very devoted, passing it on to each of us. And so instead of dividing his property when he had the opportunity to, he kept it in one piece to pass on to us. When Measure 37 came along, he did attempt to go through those steps with an attorney and attempted to divide it at that time. But as you know, that kind of ended up in a big mess. And he did file for Measure 37, but it was either he filed just for the county or just for the state, and it ended up in a big mess. And so he wasn't able to do anything there. Again, respect your wanting to look across the river and, seeing no impact, I guess. But when I look at those pictures and stuff, I don't even see our houses on those. And again, my husband did share with me that we are very, very concerned about our property and looking excellent and lending in. And again, if we had the objective of going in and dividing it in pieces and didn't care about it and wanted to sell it for large sums of money, that's not what our objective is. It is to preserve it and to make it into something beautiful that we can all enjoy and our families can enjoy. I believe that it would be beautiful and wonderful, and we would really appreciate it. Any questions?
Thank you, ma'am. The last person in favor will be Esther Smith, and after her testimony, we'll be taking a short break. So, Esther?
I recently just moved back to this area Several of my siblings have also recently moved back to this area. We want to stay in this area. We'd like to be able to stay on my grandmother's property that my grandfather bought over 50 years ago. It's his dream to develop this property. It was always his goal for our family to be able to live on this property. But it's been in our family for over 50 years. I spent much of my childhood on this property. It is a beautiful piece of property. We want to keep this property beautiful. We want to keep it in our family. And it's the desires of my family, my siblings, and my parents to move back into the area, to stay in this area, and to be able to communicate or to contribute to the community, resources, amongst other things, and to be able to stay in this area. I know that my family loves this piece of property. We would do all in our power to keep it beautiful, and so it wouldn't be a problem for our neighbors. They have been on this property for 50 years. This still is a property. It is not a farm piece of property. It is not a forest piece of property. It is good for building beautiful homes. That is what we want to do.
Any questions from the commissioners? Thank you very much, ma'am. Okay, it's 8:38. We'll recess for 5 minutes.